So we're going to pick up
and finish chapter 11 today, and we're going to move into the first part of chapter 12 of the book of John. And last week we started chapter 11, and we got through about the first 44 verses of it, and all of that was about the subject of the raising of Lazarus. And I won't recap that whole lesson, but I'll just kind of walk you through some of the high points of that. Mary, Martha, and Lazarus were very close personal friends of Jesus. And he stayed with them whenever he was down in the Jerusalem area. Bethany's not far from Jerusalem. That was his base of operation. It was a safe house for him. He could just talk and sit without worries. It's kind of like when we go visit old friends. You know, we've got a place to go and they have a place to go, and we're just thankful for that. And they were friends. And, you know, I looked up, Sue Kotcher asked me last week to see if I could figure out whether Lazarus was the oldest, the middle, or the youngest. And I never could find that answer. Martha was the oldest of the two girls, of the two women. But I don't know where Lazarus fit in. There's a lot of talk about Martha having possibly been married, but her husband had died and she was a widow, and that Mary had not been married, and that they had sort of moved in with Lazarus to keep his home place because he didn't have a wife. But he was only 30 years old. I mean, I guess that's old in Jewish times for an unmarried male, but he was 30 years old when he was raised from the dead. He lived another 30 years, so he lived about 60 years, which again was fairly old for that day and time for people to live. So I don't know who was oldest. I mean, there's some school of thought that says Martha was probably the oldest and Lazarus was in the middle and Mary was the baby, but I don't know whether that's true or not. Those of you trying to fit middle child syndrome into this discussion, I couldn't give you any spiritual advice on that, because I don't know. I couldn't find it anyway this week. But they were great friends. They were fast friends, all of them. And so Jesus was away from Bethany, and Lazarus falls ill, and the two sisters send word to Jesus via courier that Lazarus is ill. And so that courier comes. Jesus gets that courier message. And he says that this will not lead to death, but it will lead to glory. But he waits 2 days before he goes back to Bethany. And so by the time he gets back to Bethany, now we don't know how long exactly it took to get the message up there and how long it took to travel, but Lazarus had been dead 4 days when he gets back to Bethany. And so on the way, he's coming into Bethany. Martha hears about him coming into Bethany. I'm sure somebody has run ahead and told her. So she runs out to meet him. And the first thing she says to him is, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not be dead. And so they talk for a minute, and Jesus says that, he will live again. And so Martha goes back, and without even getting into the dynamics, Martha is a get-up, take-charge, busy, busy, busy person. Mary is a little more relaxed, a little more at ease in the house. And so Mary's sitting around talking to all the people. About a week after a death, in the Jewish times, people would come to the homes and they would comfort and do kind of what we do today for families that are bereaved and grieving. And so all this big commotion was going on, and Mary was back in the house. Martha was fixing food and around and just, busy, busy, busy. So she runs back to Mary and tells her that Jesus wants to see her. Well, Jesus never said that, but she says that to Mary, probably because she's irritated that Mary's just sitting there while she's up doing all the work. So Mary gets up and she goes out to see Jesus. Same comment, Lord, if you'd been here, my brother would live. He hasn't come any further. He's waited out in the countryside for Mary. But when Mary got up and moved quickly, the Jews that were in the house with her grieving had said, I wonder where she's going. She must be going to the tomb to grieve there. So they followed. So Jesus and Mary and all the people from the house have come, and Jesus says, take me to where he's buried. So they go to where he's buried, And he says, roll back the stone, Jesus does. And Martha says, Lord, he's been in there 4 days. You know, he's probably an odor in there 4 days. They, you know, there was no embalming at the time in Jewish law, and I guess in even Muslim law today, they don't embalm. They just bury people very quickly. And so in that day and time, they didn't bury them like in the ground. They had a little sepulcher or a little cave that had a little ledge in it, and they would actually wrap the body with linen, anoint it with the oils, and they would put it in there, and then they sealed the cave up to keep animals and everything else out of it, or seal the door. So, much to Martha's chagrin, I guess, he says, roll the stone away. So they do. Both of them, even though they are a little bit perturbed that Jesus didn't get there, Martha makes the comment that, Lord, even now, whatever you ask, I can do for you. And so Jesus, when they roll the stone back, he issues a call to Lazarus to come forward. Lazarus gets up, walks out. And that's sort of where we end where we ended our study last week, and it's about verse 44. So let's turn back there, because I want to read one section of that before we start the lesson. I want to read verses 43 and 44 of John chapter 11. And it says, when he had said this, Jesus called in a loud voice, Lazarus, come out. The dead man came out, his heads and feet wrapped with strips of linen and a cloth around his face. You know, you remember in Jesus' burial garment also, there was a cloth placed over the face, and then they wrapped him with strips of linen. And that's to protect the body and to hold the oils and all that kind of stuff. And they wrapped them pretty tight, so they were, I mean, if you've ever seen any of these zombie pictures, you probably get some idea of what Lazarus looks like coming out of the tomb, you know. Strips of linen probably hanging off, you know, coming out, you know, pretty bedraggled looking. And what does Jesus say, the last part of verse 44? And let him go. Now, we would think that's a pretty innocuous statement, and it is to some degree, but I guess it triggered in my mind a thought, and that thought is, you know, Lazarus was raised from the dead, physically raised from the dead, but we're raised from the dead spiritually when we are born again. And it's interesting that God had the power to raise him from the dead. Why do you think God didn't use his power to just blow those grave clothes off of him when he came out? I mean, why do you think he told the people to go take the grave clothes off of him?
He wanted them to have an active part in this.
He wanted them to have an active part in it. And I think that's a key thing for us. When people are new to the faith, they come with a lot of their wrappings of death, so to speak, on them. They come with their old ways. They come with their old thoughts. They come with their old ideas. They come with their old way they do things. And it's up to us to help them take off those old things and move into a new man to come in.
And it's also maybe that he really wanted them to see that he had raised Lazarus from the dead, because he didn't believe in the resurrection. And the other two people in the right after they had died,
Well, good point, because we talked about last week, sometimes in commentaries, this whole section is called the Glory Road, where the road from where Jesus was to Bethany was the road to glory, because it was the road where Jesus not only demonstrated that he had power over life and death, but that he truly was the anointed one of God. And that this was a powerful statement of that. We talked about how the miracles that John records are never miracles for their own sake, but they're miracles for teaching. They're miracles for us to see beyond the miracle, to see the deeper truth. And the deeper truth is that the Lord did have that power, and the Lord could raise from the dead, and that Jesus was the holder of that power. And so all of that was important. But I think the other side of it is that I think he wanted them to have a part in it. And, you know, when we think about new people coming to the faith, and, you know, the pastor always, typically when a child is dedicated, he has a prayer for the child, but he also has a prayer for those of us that are the Christian believers, that we will help that child. We will help that person become deeper in the faith, stronger in the faith. We won't be stumbling blocks for them. And I think there's a little bit of a straw in that way, in that part of the wind also, that he's trying to get people to understand that we all have a part in this. And I think it's just something that struck me, because I know, Jesus could have easily, when he raised him from the dead, had him come out and whatever was under his grave clothes. Maybe that was another issue, but I don't know what he had. I don't know how exactly all the funeral procedures, but it's just kind of an interesting thought in my mind that we are to have a part in this. And when we see somebody newly made alive in the Lord, that we, by dealing with them and sharing with them, we can see that that's real. We can see that we can see their faith, and we can see that wonder. That's sort of important. And so that's where we finished last week. In verse 45, we pick up today with the reaction to this. So picture all these people have come out of the house. They're all at the place of the tomb of Lazarus. They've all watched this thing. They all know Lazarus is dead. Jesus wasn't there. 4 days. A long, long time. 4 days he's been in the tomb. And so now Jesus calls him out. And it says in verse 45, first word is therefore. Therefore, many of the Jews who had come to visit Mary and had seen what Jesus did, put their faith in him. Many people saw that and did exactly what the Lord said it would do. It was a demonstration of power and glory, and that he was the anointed one. And then there's always these little conjunctions. Verse 46 starts with, but some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. So in any crowd, no matter how big the miracle, there's going to be people that believe and there's going to be people that don't. And so the non-believers here, the ones who didn't want to see this for what it was, or who were afraid of it, or who were just trying to be, liked by the Pharisees, went back to tell. And so what happens then? Some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. And then verse 47. Then, so remember, therefore, but then. So you sort of get a little bit of a sequence of the phrases. Therefore some believed, but some didn't, and went back to rat Jesus out. And therefore, or then, the chief priests and the Pharisees called a meeting of the Sanhedrin. So you can just imagine, that they're pretty upset with Jesus anyway for all the miracles he's doing. And if you actually go read in Luke and Matthew, you'll see many other miracles during this time that John doesn't call out, because John's purpose is to demonstrate that Christ is the anointed one and the Messiah, and that he's divine and that he's God. And so he's telling us of the miracles that make that case very plain for us. They call a meeting. Let me just figure out where I am here. So, in the latter part of verse 47, it says, "What are we accomplishing?" they ask. This is the Sanhedrin, and that's a pretty good question. Anytime we get together as Christians, we ought to ask ourselves something like, what are we accomplishing? What are we doing? Of course, their question was not related to how can we glorify the Lord. Their question was really more related to how can we stop this? But it's a good question nevertheless, and I think it's something that we ought to ask ourselves. How am I doing? What am I doing? Am I doing what I should be doing? Clearly, the Pharisees and the Sanhedrin here, and the Sadducees, were not doing what God had hoped, but what God knew what they were going to do. They were all part of his plan, and you'll see that in a second. So, what are we doing, they ask? Here is this man performing many miraculous signs. Verse 48. Notice the pronouns here. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him, And then the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation. So you can see very clearly from the wording here that the Sanhedrin was not interested in whether Jesus was authentic. They were really interested in whether the Romans were going to take away their power and their positions of authority within the ruling kingdom there, you know, within that ruling. Because Romans, as you recall, in most states they took over, would allow the local population to continue some of their traditions as long as they didn't go directly against Rome. And so the Jews could continue to run their Sanhedrin and do their, you know, Jewish, sort of Jewish work. The Romans were somewhat amused by it anyway, and they would let them do that. But the Jews were very interested in maintaining power. It's a good time to point out also that all of the priests in this day and time were Sadducees. The Pharisees were really the, there was never very many Pharisees. The Sadducees were the ruling class, the aristocracy, if you will. The chief priest was a Sadducee. And there was this whole discussion, as Tony brought up earlier, about resurrection. Because the Sadducees didn't believe in resurrection. So the whole notion of a resurrection was foreign to them. And the chief priest, a guy named Caiaphas, was a Sadducee. And so the whole idea of a resurrection was foreign to him. He didn't like it. He didn't think it was right. And so he was going to stop it. And so, but their concern is, if they let him keep doing all these miracles, the population will believe. All the Jews will begin to believe. And then where goes, because then the Romans will get irritated, and then there goes their power. And then verse 49 is kind of a telling verse. Now John, if you recall, wrote this book around 95 AD. So this is happening about 30 AD. So he writes this about 65 years later. And that becomes important in a minute. Then one of them named Caiaphas, who was the high priest that year, actually for about 18 years he was high priest, spoke up. And what does it say that he said? You know nothing at all. Now, anybody have different translations besides that? It sort of says, if you had any sense at all, that's what he's basically saying. You guys, if you had any sense at all, you do not realize that it is better for you that one man die for the people than the whole nation perish. Kind of interesting, because obviously he was talking about the physical nation perishing and their physical control perishing. So it was a simpler matter for them to kill Jesus and do away with the threat than it was to let Jesus continue and let people believe and create a situation where the Romans had to come put down the whole situation. But Caiaphas was the high priest. And in Jewish tradition and law, the high priest was the one that spoke for God to the people. And it's kind of interesting because if we don't see what Caiaphas says, John reminds us in the next verse. Verse 51 says, he did not say this on his own, but as high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the Jewish nation, and not only for that nation, but also for the scattered children of God, to bring them together and make them one. So from that day on, they plotted to take his life. Now, it's interesting. This is an interesting point. You remember what year Rome sacked Jerusalem? AD 70. John writes this in AD 95. So Rome has already sacked Israel. Israel's already been, the temple has been destroyed. The Israelis have been carried off, or the Judeans, or whatever they were there, had been carried off and dispersed to all parts of the Roman Empire. And Caiaphas is concerned about the Romans taking over physically. He's not concerned about spiritually. So when Jesus' death on the cross was that point in time that galvanized so many people to become believers in that era, and of course, you know, a lot of people became really fed up with the Romans, and you can read all about Maccabees, and you can read all about other people in Jewish history, but the Romans just got tired of it. And they came and they sacked them and they destroyed the temple and they wiped it out and they sent all the Jews packing. So Caiaphas was actually prophesying what was actually going to happen. But he was talking about physical, but God turned it into a spiritual thing. Jesus died for the nation, but not that the physical nation would be spared, but that the spiritual nation of Israel would be spared. And not just Israel, but all who believe. And that's what John brings back today. So it's kind of interesting that as we make our schemes and plots, and we think about what we're going to do to build our power and hold our power, that God is ultimately in control. And whatever we do, God will have the last word. And whatever we do in God's name, God can make something good happen out of it, even if it's not what we intended to happen. And that's what we see here. I mean, it's a tragedy for the Jewish people who lived in Jerusalem that it was sacked. It's not a tragedy for the Jewish nation and the people of God, because it set the stage for spiritual renewal and that spiritual deliverance that we know as Gentiles, but that they will know also, you know, if they come to know the Lord. So it's kind of interesting. And John, by writing his gospel last, is sort of pointing out the obvious to us. You know, if we don't see it, he's going to make sure we see it, because he wants us to see that Caiaphas, by prophesying and being God's spokesman, even though he didn't know it, was actually prophesying what God had told him to do. And he was acting out God's wishes that Jesus be sacrificed for the nation. And so it's kind of interesting. In one way, you sort of think, well, God had a hand in all of that, and he did. But it's the other thing to know that God worked a miracle out of it for all of us. And it says, 53, it says, from that day on, they plotted to take his life. Now, we know that's the case, and we see that this is the time moving fairly quickly towards the time of the crucifixion. In verse 54, it says, Therefore, Jesus no longer moved about publicly among the Jews. Instead, he withdrew to a region near the desert to a village called Ephraim, where he stayed with his disciples. So it was not time yet. It was not the Passover time, not time for him to be crucified. So Jesus withdraws and goes out to pray and to work with his disciples. And between these verses, if you go look at Luke 17 through 19, you will see Jesus didn't just retire and then come back. He was busy doing other things, but he had gone all the way back up to Galilee. He was ministering in Galilee. As he came back down to Jerusalem, he was ministering in Samaria, and he comes on down into Judea. And then we see the beginning of this end in chapter 12 here. 55 says, when it was almost time for the Jewish Passover, many went up from the country to Jerusalem for their ceremonial cleansing before the Passover. Now, when it says up, it really means altitude, not necessarily direction, north, south, east, or west. So many of these people went to Jerusalem. Before they could celebrate the Passover, they had to be ceremonially purified. And the way they did that was they would go to the temple area, and they would go through this prescribed set of sacrifices. That they would give sacrifices, they would go through ceremonial washings. It was all done to make them pure and to stand before the Lord. You know, we say at the Lord's Supper that if you have something against your brother, you should go make that right before you come back and take the Lord's Supper. It's our way of saying that we should be ceremonially pure. We should not hold any hate or harbor any resentments or any of that other stuff that we probably ignore most of the time. But anyway, we should do the same thing. We should go get ourselves in a frame of mind where the worship of the Lord's Supper can become a memorial hymn to him and not just an act that we go through. And so the Jews were preparing ceremonially for the Passover. Huge feast for them. Much symbolic reference. But also, the priests could pay attention to everybody who came to give offerings and to become ceremonially pure. So it says here, they kept looking for Jesus as they stood in the temple area. They asked one another, what do you think? Isn't he coming to the feast at all? But the chief priests and Pharisees had given orders that if anyone found out where Jesus was, they should report it so that they might arrest him. So people were watching the temple area for Jesus to come because they thought if he came, he was a good rabbi, he would come and become ceremonially pure, you know, before the Passover time. And then we begin chapter 12, and we're only going to go through the first 11 verses of this. So 6 days before the Passover, Jesus arrives at Bethany. So he's coming back to Jerusalem. He stops at Bethany, Lazarus, Mary, and Martha, and then he's got his entourage of disciples with him. Stopped at Bethany, where Lazarus lived, and where Jesus, whom Jesus had raised from the dead. Here a dinner was given in Jesus' honor. Martha served, which we figured out, while Lazarus was among those reclining at the table. And then Mary took a pint of pure nard, an expensive perfume, and she poured it on Jesus' feet and wiped his feet with her hair, and the house was filled with the fragrance of perfume. Now, if you go back to some of the other Gospels, you'll see where Martha goes up to Jesus and says, "Lord, what do you think about her just sitting here while I do all the work?" You know, it's kind of interesting. John leaves that out of the narrative, but it's in some of the other Gospels. It's kind of interesting. But he does include a similar comment from Judas. So picture this. This pint of this nard, whatever nard is a very fragrant, pungent perfume. And it was used very sparingly. It was used also to anoint bodies. But this was like a year's wage for this pint of nard. So she pours it over his feet and wipes it with her hair. The aroma is everywhere in the house. So one of his disciples, Judas Iscariot, who was later to betray him, objected and said, "Why wasn't this perfume sold and the money given to the poor? It was worth a year's wages." I'm going to stop there for a second. I want you to think about the scene here. We've got Lazarus. We've got Mary and Martha. We've got Jesus' disciples. Certainly John is there. You know, I'm sure the others are there. We know Judas is there. And it's interesting about the way people react to Jesus. You know, if you look at Mary, Martha, and Lazarus, while they questioned him on a few things, they loved him intensely. And everything they did showed that love for him. Everything they did honored him and honored what he did. Was respectful of him being the anointed one of the Messiah. Judas was also among his friends. But it's interesting to note that Judas was more concerned with the cost of the perfume than he was anything else. And he says that he was concerned about it because he said it should have been given to the poor. But John doesn't leave it there. John tells a pretty good story, and he says next, in verse 6, someone want to read verse 6 for me?
"He did not say this because he cared about the poor, but because he was a thief. As keeper of the money bag, he used to help himself to what was put in it."
Yeah, kind of interesting, isn't it? I mean, John, now this is John not looking at the time, but John looking from 60 years later and understanding what happened. He understood that Judas was no friend of the Lord, that Judas was a thief. Judas was a member of the group because he was going to be the betrayer, but his true nature came through. And it's kind of interesting. The thought occurred to me, you can be so close and yet so far. And I think about that in our own terms as Christians today. There are people, believe it or not, who are in the church who profess to be Christians, who come every week, but that's essentially it. Their service is a week. They come every week and they sit in church. But yet, they don't really see the deeper picture. They miss the connection with the Lord. And the relationship with Him is what's really critical. It's not whether we come to church every Sunday night, Wednesday night, whatever. I mean, that's important for fellowship, but what's really important is that should be an outgrowth of our beliefs as opposed to just something we do because, you know, we're church people. It ought to be because we come with the right heart and the right spirit. Clearly, Judas didn't have that. It's kind of amazing to me. He could see the miracles. He could be with him the whole time. He could listen to his teaching and yet be so far away from being saved. And it's kind of terrifying. You know, Pastor was saying the other day, I guess it was a, I don't know whether it was a deacon's meeting. I think it was a deacon's meeting. He made a comment the other day that he wasn't so worried about the things he didn't know in the Bible. He was really more concerned about the things he did know and didn't do. And isn't that the way it is with us? There are things that we know God wants us to do that we don't do. Let's not worry about the things we don't know. If we just pay attention to the things we know and do what God has called us to do, how much better off would we be? I mean, how much better off in this situation? Judas knew what to do, but that was not what he was going to do. And it just sort of struck me here as we're going through that. And so Jesus has a comment also in verse 7. What does Jesus say? So after Judas turns around and kind of blisters Mary for pouring the nard on his feet, kind of an important verse for us. Verse 7 says, "Leave her alone," Jesus replied. "It was intended that she should save this perfume for the day of my burial. You will always have the poor among you, but you will not always have me." Well, this is an interesting statement. I mean, people take this and, you know, make all kinds of sermons out of it and everything else. But what Jesus was saying was not that we shouldn't care about the poor, not that we shouldn't try to help the poor, but the poor are always going to be here. And in this life, there will never be a time until he comes back where we don't have poor. That's always going to be the way it is. I mean, we can look around the world, and I don't care how much money you give to save the children or how much money you give to whatever, there's going to be poor people. There's always going to be poor people. And so what he was saying here was she felt the need to anoint me. And, of course, he was looking to his burial when they didn't have time to anoint him. So she was doing that substitute anointment. And John sort of sees this after the fact. And he's kind of making that plain to all of us. And then in verse 9 it says, "Meanwhile, a large crowd of Jews found out that Jesus was there and came, not only because of him, but also to see Lazarus, whom he had raised from the dead." So Lazarus was probably a celebrity. You know, people wanted to see and say, you know, that's the guy that Jesus raised from the dead. You know, that's the, just like we do, you know, we always go to see celebrities, you know, whether they're famous or infamous. You know, we want to see who they are, you know, look at them, stare at them. And people were doing that here. And then verse 10, it says, "So," and again, I would remind you, these little connective phrases that are in here are kind of interesting because they give a lot of power to the way we can read these verses. You know, so the crowd is gathered. They've come to see Lazarus, and because of that, so the chief priests made plans to kill Lazarus as well, for on account of him, many of the Jews were going over to Jesus and putting their faith in him. And I think that's kind of interesting. We don't know much about Lazarus. We don't know a lot about his life after this. There's some church traditions that are around. You go on the internet, you'll read about St. Lazarus or so-and-so. Most of that is hocus-pocus. There's no basis in it. It's early church tradition to try to make saints out of all these people. We don't know, in reality, we don't know much about what happened to Lazarus, you know, after this time. But it's pretty apparent that Lazarus, not only by his physical presence, but by his discussion, was winning people to the Lord. And I think it's kind of interesting because all God asks us to do is tell our own story. Tell what God has done for us. In Lazarus' case, it's pretty dramatic. It's, "I was dead and now I'm alive." In the blind beggar, it's, "I was blind and now I see." You know, in the lepers, it's, "I had leprosy and now I don't." You know, in the paralyzed man, it's, "I couldn't walk and now I can." Those are pretty dramatic statements. But all of us have stories that we can tell about what God has done for us. And those are the things that when people come to talk to us, ought to be on our mind. We ought to be thankful. We ought to be talking about what God is doing. Because wouldn't it be nice to have been said of us that because of us and because of our testimony, people are coming to the Lord? I mean, that would be nice to have that as part of your legacy. That whoever you are, that you were telling the story of Jesus and you were talking about what God had done in your life. And I think it's pretty apparent that Lazarus had done this. And so again, Lazarus means God who helps. And so it's the same word as Eleazar, which is the Hebrew word for Lazarus. Is the Greek word, well, Eleazar is the Hebrew word. So kind of interesting, Lazarus was helped by God, and it's clear that Lazarus also told the story of the Lord. So we're going to stop here, and we're going to pick up, now we begin the route into Jerusalem, and we begin the story of the crucifixion, so that will begin the next half of this chapter. Any comments or questions, any thoughts?
Okay. Lloyd. When it says, you will always have the poor among you, and but you will not always have me, that is paralleled in a lot of people's lives right now. As far as tell your loved ones right now that you love them while you can, while they're with you, to do what you can for those who are.
Yeah, that's a powerful analogy for sure. That we, we should never miss that chance to tell our loved ones that we love them and that God loves them. And that's important. It's important for our own sanity too. You know, that after they're gone, we feel like we've at least had that discussion. You know, people always try to get to the bedside of someone they think is going to pass because they can have that last conversation, or they can share something with them, and it's always a heartbreak if that doesn't happen. And I just pray that we'll always take that advantage, and we'll never be at a time where we haven't left that legacy with our loved ones. And our friends. A good point. Any other comments or questions?
Yeah, you said that the chief priest came to kill him. The third vision was that God is protecting us.
God is protecting Lazarus. There's a little bit of church history that's probably accurate about what happened to him, but they say he moved to another area and moved out of the area. That's probably one reason why he was saved. But God certainly directed him to do that, and it's kind of important. If you ever get bored for something to read, and you go back and you want to get a good book, like Erdman's or one of the others on church history, it's amazing to go read the early church history. You don't get it in Acts, you get a lot of it in Acts, but you can go get a lot of the stuff that's not in Acts, and kind of what happened to all these people as they played out, and all the early people involved in the early church. Kind of a powerful testimony to God's delivering of his own people. So, good points. Any others?
Can I make an announcement?
Sure.
It's not about the lesson, but I don't know how many of you know Rhonda Stone. She comes here occasionally. But she told me last year after Danny had passed away that she was going to walk and Relay for Life. Well, she's a cancer survivor. And she was there and walked in that walk. And then she walked all night. And if you know Rhonda, you know that she has bad teeth. And I worked at a dental office about 10 years, so I know this teeth. But anyway, I noticed it when I first met her last year. And I had mentioned it to David Dahl. He knows Rhonda. And